Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle Public School students are heading back to school tomorrow, just as a key school election campaign heats up. The campaign over who will guide our state's education policy. Aaron Jones and Chris Rakedahl are competing for the job of Superintendent of Public Instruction. Here to tell you more, KUOW's education reporter. Hi, Ann Dornfeld.
How's it going?
It's good. Let's start with what the Superintendent of Public Instruction does, please.
You know, it's a really good question. It is a largely ceremonial position, though. Technically, they're in charge of administering the state's K-12 education program, making sure that teachers are getting paid and that teacher certifications are working as they should. But what you see more from the school's chief in reality is advocacy. You hear them talking about the importance of education funding or how teachers should be evaluated or how students should be tested. We've heard a lot of that from the current chief, Randy Dorn. But the actual policy is in the hands of the legislature.
The legislature. Okay. So the candidates so far are Aaron Jones. Well, we are down to two candidates. Aaron Jones, Chris Rakedahl. Let's get to know them. What do you know about Chris Rakedahl?
He's a three-term Democratic state representative from Tumwater. He's in his third term right now. He has been a teacher, and he is currently the vice chair of the House Education Committee.
And Aaron Jones?
Also a former teacher. She's worked at OSPI, the state education department, where she's hoping to lead, as an assistant superintendent focusing on policy recommendations regarding matters of student achievement.
Some listeners may have heard our discussion of this race on Friday on the Week in Review. We discussed one of the big issues that has come up between these candidates, their stance on issues of gender and sexual orientation. How did that enter this discussion?
Right. Well, beginning next year, the state has some new learning standards regarding sexual orientation and gender. So basically, kindergartners are supposed to learn that there can be different ways to express gender. So I'm a girl who might like to play football, and my brother might like to play with dolls, and that's cool. And a couple of grades later, kids are supposed to learn that it's important to be respectful of how other people express their gender or not teasing a transgender classmate. And then moving on from there, learning about sexual orientation. A conservative group in Washington surveyed the candidates for school's chief some months back and asked them what they thought about the new guidelines. And Rakedahl said they sounded good to him. He thinks that's, you know, very important. Jones, though, said that she didn't think it was developmentally appropriate to talk about gender or sexual orientation with five-year-olds or to have elementary students feel, quote, feel additional pressure to choose an orientation. So that concerned some people who thought that it showed that Jones considers sexual orientation a choice and that it's insensitive to trans kids to not to allow lessons that might help them be accepted by their peers from the jump off.
Okay, so some people didn't like Aaron Jones' statements. How much do her personal views on this matter? How much influence over LGBTQ issues in schools does she have? Or would whoever the superintendent would be?
Yeah, I mean, not directly, but quite potentially indirectly. But it would also matter what kind of firewall she puts up between what she personally thinks and what it is her job to pursue. So I think that some people point to research that shows that it is okay for young children to learn about issues of gender. It's very helpful, and that it is developmentally appropriate if presented in a certain way, and that children can learn about issues of sexual orientation from an early age, and that if she's not in touch with what research shows, that is a concern that her personal beliefs may be taking precedence.
What impact has this whole controversy had on the election race?
Well, Seattle's alternative news weekly, The Stranger, had originally endorsed Jones, but when they found out what she'd told that organization, they switched their endorsement to Rakedahl. And Equal Rights Washington had also endorsed Jones and changed their endorsement too. Jones has written open letters saying that she was taken the wrong way or that she misspoke and that she is very dedicated to the rights of LGBTQ people and that her work shows that personally and professionally.
So, Ann, again, you're our education reporter. You're covering this campaign for the state superintendent of public instruction. What are you going to be watching for as this race progresses?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, there are some differences between Jones and Rakedahl. Jones is the political outsider, and Rakedahl has been in the House for several years now. But I think that they are very close on a lot of issues when it comes to issues of testing, narrowing the achievement gap. They've shown a lot of dedication to that. And they're concerned, very concerned about education funding and aggressively pursuing improved funding, dramatically improved funding in the legislature. So we have two very progressive candidates, and people are really kind of looking for ways to discern between the two. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how they distinguish themselves from each other as the race continues.
Our education reporter, Ann Dornfeld, will continue to watch this election campaign for State Superintendent of Public Instruction between Aaron Jones and Chris Rakedahl. Ann, thanks for updating us.
My pleasure.
This is KUOW's The Record.
Merhaban.
Ni hao.
Hello.
Bonjour.
Namaste.
Yes,
hey.
Ciao.
Hello.
Our series, Upon Arrival, following the experience of new refugees in America. Refugees are arriving here at a time of divisive politics around resettlement. It's a time of heightened emotions, too. Emotions from compassion to suspicion to fear. KUOW's race and culture reporter Liz Jones followed three new arrivals during their first year in Seattle. Today we meet a couple from Iran who race against a countdown clock to land their first job.
It's moving day at apartment number 302 in Kent, just south of Seattle. Payman Karimi and his wife Netta hope it's their last move for a while. They left a tumultuous life in Iran 3 years ago, then waited in Turkey, uncertain where their refugee case would lead. The upheaval left them broke and brokenhearted. In this home, the weight of the past will lift and new challenges will surface. But this day is one to enjoy. Netta checks out the kitchen.
So Netta, you're looking at the stove here. It's okay?
Yes.
Her chatty brother-in-law, Reza, lives nearby. He jumps in as our interpreter.
In our country, we don't have the stuff like that. Just as work with gas.
Here is electric.
Yeah.
In Iran, Netta trained as a pastry chef and worked in a bakery. Payman steps out to a small balcony. He's still clutching the rental papers in his hand.
$865.
That's your monthly rent.
Yeah. Rent.
So how will you be able to pay that next month and the month after?
I need a job. I like working because I'm young.
Payman worked as an electrician and a welding inspector in Iran. He dropped out of college to make money. Netta and Payman are both close to 40. You often catch Netta with a half smile, half furrow. Her family teases her that she worries a lot. Her nickname is Netta Stress. Payman's got a sweep of dark hair and a playful laugh.
Everything for me is different and change. Country change. Language change, city change. And
Reza teases that even Payman's accent has changed. He sounds Russian.
Okay.
I never see Iranian people speak English like that.
Reza also came as a refugee 3 years ago, and he hands down some advice to Payman.
For first, you have to do anything. Doesn't matter if housekeeping, cleaning, dishwasher. After a few months, you can find a better job and change your job.
Netta and Payman will soon discover this is more difficult than it sounds. Here's a snapshot of Netta and Payman's budget. Together, they get a one-time federal grant of about $2,000 as welcome money, then around $400 a month for up to 8 months or until they find a job, whichever comes first.
Clearly, that doesn't stretch very far. That gets them maybe a month and a half in.
This is Cordelia Revels, the resettlement case manager with Jewish Family Service.
So there is a lot of pressure to find work immediately and just to find any job that can pay the bills.
The U.S. resettlement program steers refugees toward employment and self-sufficiency right away. Various government programs help with job placement for up to 5 years, and the Office of Refugee Resettlement tracks the outcomes. The agency's 2014 report to Congress shows about half the refugees in its caseload found employment. Outcomes steadily improve over time, but the early years can be rough. For Netta and Payman, the job search will not go smoothly. Back in the kitchen, Netta opens drawers and cabinets. I ask how it compares to their last place. Reza interprets.
her home in Iran was better than here. But Turkey, I can't say it was garbage can.
Oh, yeah. This is better than Turkey.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. 100% better than Turkey.
In the months ahead, I'll never learn exactly why Neda and Peyman left Iran. They say it was a lot of things, as we talk one afternoon with an interpreter.
Did anything happen? Like, what? Did something happen to you?
Yes.
Something negative?
Yes,
something bad?
Not for me, but for Neda.
Is that something you can talk about, or?
No. She doesn't feel comfortable to talk about it because it's gonna bring everything back to her again.
That's okay. I'm sorry that happened to you.
All Neda says is her case is religious. The rest is confidential. The U.S. defines a refugee as someone with a well-founded fear of persecution in their home country. Iran is a majority Muslim country. Religious minorities face discrimination, surveillance, and arrest. Peyman and Neda are Christian.
I'm in Kent, outside the office of Jewish Family Service, and I'm here to meet Neda and Peyman. Today is their three-month check-in, and their case manager has described this to me as kind of a come-to-Jesus moment. They'll look at all their expenses and the money they have to cover that, and they'll really need to figure out how they're going to make ends meet, especially with some benefits ending soon.
Hi, I'm Alana.
Hi, Alana.
Thank you for coming in. It's really nice to meet you both. So next Monday is the last day of your 90 days, but you shouldn't worry. You have other things lined up that you have applied for. So those are the things that we'll go over when we go through your budget so that you know exactly what to expect after next week.
This is an exit interview. Neda and Peyman are at the three-month mark, and that's how long this agency is contracted to help them. It's a gentle push out of the nest. The caseworker checks on how they're adapting. She starts with a softball question. Do you know your address? An interpreter translates.
He knows their address, but she doesn't.
It's really very important that you also carry it with you if there was an emergency or something.
Then the caseworker cuts to the chase. How do you plan to pay the bills going forward? Neda answers.
Peyman has to work.
They're both eager to get jobs, but due to a government delay, their work authorization just arrived today, nearly 2 months late. They'd been waiting on that to put in applications. Their savings will last a few more weeks, so the race is on. And that's not all. They got some big news the other day, the kind of news that changes your life and all your calculations.
That was KUOW's race and culture reporter Liz Jones, and we'll pick up on this story tomorrow. This is part of a KUOW series this month about refugee resettlement. It's called Upon Arrival, and you can see all the stories in this series at our website, KUOW.org. Right across the top of the homepage there, just click where it says Upon Arrival.
KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. It's 12:21, cloudy and 61 degrees in Seattle.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, Latinos were a big part of the birth of hip-hop culture.
There was no formula to say, you have to do it this way. We were all learning from each other and building it and making it up as we went along.
Our crew brings you the Latino history of hip-hop, part one. That's next time on Latino USA.
Tonight at 11 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. KUOW also broadcasts from Bellingham at 90.3 FM. And in Olympia, you can hear us at 1340 AM.
Support for KUOW comes from the lawyers of Hillis, Clark, Martin, and Peterson in Seattle. HCMP connects clients to a broad range of business and financial solutions. Hillis, Clark, Martin, and Peterson at hcmp.com.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Do you have canvas bags in your car trunk just sitting there waiting for a trip to the grocery store? Good for you. That is one less plastic bag in the Great Pacific garbage patch. But here's the bad news. If it's carbon footprint you care about, then you might be better off choosing plastic bags. Noah Dillon wrote about this in The Atlantic. He says there is a way to even things out a bit, but it does require commitment.
You can make it equivalent if you use a canvas bag something like 327 times. But a lot of people,
what about if I leave them in my trunk accidentally 327 times and don't
actually... That's the thing, yeah. I mean, you either have to commit to using it effectively and often, which isn't very hard to do, or you should probably not collect them and use them at all, because it just ends up the amount of resources that are put into producing them is much larger than the amount of resources that's put into producing those plastic bags that are so bad for the environment. I mean, they really are bad for the environment, but they're not as bad as an underutilized tote bag.
Why? What's such a resource hog about tote bags, canvas tote bags?
Well, from start to finish, they use up a lot of resources. They require, you know, a lot of water and fertilizer to grow the canvas. They use a lot of energy in their harvesting, their production. All that stuff takes fossil fuels and manual labor. They are much heavier than those plastic bags, so it takes a lot more energy to move them around. And then if they're poorly produced, their life cycle can be really short, and then they end up in a landfill. And that sort of calculation isn't really added into our perception of what a tote bag is.
So should we not buy any more canvas bags?
Well, the thing is that you don't really have to buy them to get them. I mean, they're given out all over the place because they're good advertising space. And so if you are like me or a lot of other people, you kind of end up with a ton of these things just to begin with.
Is there any better option between canvas and plastic? What about, aren't there recyclable eco totes that are better?
Yeah, those, according to the data that we have from 2006, require about 26 uses to be at parity with a plastic bag as far as carbon expenditure per use. The trick, again, is just like getting one that is durable enough to last through those 26 or more uses.
Got it. Noah, you usually write about art. Is there a connection between art criticism and canvas bags?
Well, kind of. I mean, this started off with me walking around New York and seeing tote bags thrown away all over the place and thinking about them as like an image of ecological responsibility, as opposed to the reality of people taking on all these tote bags and then just treating them like disposable plastic bags, even though their resource expenditure is so much higher. And these sorts of like large scale or kind of unseen problems don't make it into the picture in our head of what we're doing or what we can do to be more ecologically conscientious.
Noah Dillon, thanks so much for this.
No, thank you.
Oh, and Noah, just for the record, are you a secret operative of the plastic bag lobby? Because I think our listeners would want to know that.
Yeah. No, I mean, look.
You're not directly answering the question. It sounds like you are a secret operative of the plastic bag lobby. Is that fair?
In no way, shape, or form have I ever received any money from Big Plastic Bag or its affiliates. No, I mean, I've got no love for the plastic bag industry. It's just that the way that people use tote bags is more harmful than using plastic bags. That's really the point of the essay. Not that everybody should use plastic bags, but that they should use the tote bags that they have more and better than they currently do.
So I don't need to throw away my dozens of canvas bags. Now that I've got them, use them a lot.
You should use them. You should use them. You should use them as much as you possibly can.
Noah Dillon is the author of this recent article in The Atlantic called "Are Tote Bags Really Good for the Environment?" And by the way, if you're planning to use those tote bags more than 300 times, would you wash them? Because we're tweeting out a link right now to NPR's story on tote bag bacteria. Thanks. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. It may soon be legal to shoot heroin and smoke meth in Seattle, at least in certain places. The city is strongly considering safe consumption sites where people could use these illegal drugs with medical professionals there monitoring. We'd be the first city in America to do this. Chris Nyrop has been working with addicts in King County for years. He consults with the mayor's heroin task force. Nyrop says he hopes safe consumption sites will lead to something else, safe consumption housing.
One of the things that we know from looking at drug consumption rooms around the world is that the majority of people who are using those facilities are using them because they're homeless, and they would otherwise be using public bathrooms or public parks. So providing them a space to use is good, but it does not solve the underlying issue of the fact that those folks are homeless. And when the drug consumption room isn't open, they would be using elsewhere, or if they're not near one, they will still be using outdoors. And this places them at increased risk for HIV, hepatitis C, and drug overdose, but it also poses a public safety hazard for the wider community.
Why doesn't the city of Seattle let people do illegal drugs behind their own walls in their government-subsidized apartment?
So that's what's happening now. I mean, there is no secret about the fact that people are using drugs in transitional housing at the moment. And we know this because people are suffering from overdoses in those rooms, and we get 911 calls for emergency responses. So we know that that's taking place. The problem is it's taking place in a sort of don't ask, don't tell, wink, wink, nudge, nudge capacity. And what we would love to see is it come out in the open behind closed doors where it can be supervised and monitored.
The city has one apartment building that I know of where you're allowed to drink in your apartment, your transitional housing apartment. A lot of folks have called that 1811 because it's at 1811 East Lake. What is the connection between 1811, wet housing we call it, and what you would like to see?
1811 serves as an absolutely great model for what we would like to see. So 1811 was one of the first of its kind housing first, supportive housing for people who use alcohol. It's been replicated throughout the United States and in Canada. And unfortunately, we would love to see more of it here in Seattle because it is such a good model. And they did one building. It's been very successful. And that the conversation around it kind of stopped there. The need for it did not stop.
As you know, drinking alcohol is legal. We're talking about illegal drugs. How could the city of Seattle be in the business of supporting and subsidizing transitional housing and letting you do illegal drugs?
That is a great question, and that is where the devil is completely in the details. You are absolutely correct. The difference between 1811, where people are consuming alcohol on site, is that they can go to a corner store and they can buy alcohol and they can bring it back. What we would love to see is sort of an integration of a safe consumption room in a housing facility. So people would be provided with housing. There would be a safe consumption site in the building. They would still have to go outdoors elsewhere to purchase their drugs and bring them back. Drug consumption rooms anywhere in the world have had to face this one little bit of hurdle because everywhere that they are operating, drugs like heroin and cocaine are illegal, and people do have to purchase their drugs in the illicit market and bring them in. That hurdle has been well handled in other cases. What we would love to see is a test model here of doing it in a housing and a safe consumption site at the same time.
Would the rule be you're not allowed to shoot heroin in your apartment? You have to come downstairs in this safe consumption site?
Yeah, I hate to use the term rule, but I think that would be the strong recommendation for folks. And my guess is that folks, in fact, would actually do it. That you wouldn't have to be draconian.
Why? Why would people do that?
Because we've done lots of focus groups and interviews with people at syringe exchange sites and even at the drug consumption rooms who say that they would prefer to use there because it's a sterile, hygienic environment. And in case something goes wrong, there's someone there to help them.
You've said that the Pacific Northwest is a leader here. How is that?
Well, absolutely. And there had been a long-running series of debates and sort of civic actions around getting syringe exchange started throughout the early to mid-1980s in the United States. And then in 1988, Dave Purchase down in Tacoma did a very brilliant thing, which is he went to his local health department and the police department and said, look, I'm going to do this, and I'm not asking that you support me. What I am asking is that you don't oppose me. And so in August of 1988 in Tacoma, he started the first established syringe exchange program in the United States. This was immediately followed by Seattle and Portland. And so from the beginning, the Northwest of the United States has been the area with the highest level of syringe exchange availability. And it's no coincidence that we also have among the lowest rates of HIV infection in the United States among injection drug users. And, you know, just to give you an example of how far ahead we were, places like North Carolina are just now, today, getting legal syringe exchange.
If Seattle doesn't go as far as allowing illegal drugs in its transitional housing, but what we do go to safe consumption sites with illegal drugs, how momentous would just that step be?
That step in and of itself would be huge for the United States. As I mentioned before, you know, Vancouver has had its safe consumption facility InSite since 2003. They've been operating in the Netherlands since the early to mid-1980s. But we have faced this stumbling block in the United States of really never getting beyond a conversation about it. And it seems like we're at a moment now where in Seattle and in a few other cities around the United States, people are right at the edge of the cliff and willing to make the leap. And it would be a huge one.
Chris, how do you convince the city of Seattle that this is not just coddling, enabling? Let's make illegal drug addiction, let's make it warm and safe and positive. Why would we want to do that?
Multiple answers to that, which is, so first let's just go to the term enabling for a second. That is often used as a very, very pejorative term, as if you're sort of facilitating people and you're keeping them in a situation that's bad. One of the things that those of us who have been involved in harm reduction and syringe exchange have been talking about since the late 1980s is people who are dead can't get treatment. And that what we're looking at is providing spaces where people can use, where they're not going to be contracting diseases like HIV or hepatitis C, or where they're not going to be dying of an overdose. And providing them that facility, which again has both enormous public health and public safety benefits for the wider community, but it also helps that individual. And one of the things that we've seen time and time again in city after city in the United States, the largest source of referral to drug treatment is often from the local syringe exchange site. So this is actually a stepping stone rather than some sort of, you know, enabling abyss where people are going to be.
Chris, some people are concerned that safe consumption sites, as they were concerned with the needle exchange sites, this is going to create more and attract more illegal drug users. What does the data say?
So that's a great question. The data on that actually was compelled by the federal government, because when the debate around syringe exchange in the U.S. started in the late 1980s, there was this concern that it would facilitate drug use and that it would not, in fact, lower rates of HIV. And so the prohibition on using federal funds was contingent on showing two things, one of which was that it did not result in increased drug use, and B, that it did in fact reduce levels of infectious disease. So by the mid-1990s, there were six federally funded studies that demonstrated conclusively that both of those were true. It did not promote increased drug use, and it did reduce infectious disease. And there have been dozens of studies since then.
What are the odds Seattle and King County create at least safe consumption sites a la Vancouver, if not also housing that allows illegal drug use?
The housing one, I really wouldn't want to place an odds bet on at this point, because I think it's just a little bit too new for a lot of folks. The idea of a safe consumption room, I am, in the upper 90% confident that the task force that the executive and the mayor have convened is going to strongly recommend the opening of safe consumption facilities. And I am extremely hopeful that that recommendation will be so strong that the mayor and the executive will follow through with it. I think we're at a point now where the coalition of folks representing law enforcement, public health, and community groups is pretty much unanimous that this is something that needs to be done.
Seattle would be the first city in America to allow these safe consumption rooms. This is new territory. What is your message to listeners who are unfamiliar and unsure about this?
I recognize that for a lot of folks, this is like hearing that we've just landed on Mars and found people living there, that this is really something extraordinary. What I would say to folks is look at the evidence of other harm reduction type programs, such as Syringe Exchange and such as the 1811 Eastlake Building, housing for people who are still using alcohol. Look at that data, which is overwhelming in terms of its public health success and its cost savings to the public, and just kind of extrapolate from that and give this a chance. We know that it has worked in many, many other countries. It has dramatically reduced disease, it has reduced cost, and it has increased public safety. And there's no reason to think that the United States would be such an anomalous place that a similar program could not be successful here.
Chris Nyrop is with the nonprofit Public Defender Association. He is a consultant with Seattle's Heroin Task Force, which is expected to formally recommend safe consumption sites in the city later this month. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. You can see it coming, the end of that book that you've been reading and enjoying, and you're starting to think, what am I going to read next? Well, Nancy Pearl is here to help, along with KUOW's Marcy Silman.
I'm not ready to let go of summer. However, we're into September, Labor Day's over, and it's time, when it comes to literature, to get serious. And Nancy Pearl, today you've brought in not one, but two books that are to be published, correct?
Yes, these are both books coming out November 1st. And I have to say that this last quarter of the year, there are some wonderful books that are coming out. And I brought two of my favorites, two that I'm so excited about.
Well, let's talk about the nonfiction, because we are in the throes of a very unusual presidential campaign. We're talking a lot about character. And this is part of a long biographical series of probably the most famous first lady of the 20th century, or the most substantive, I guess, Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yes. So years ago now, Blanche Wisen Cook wrote a biography about the early years of Eleanor Roosevelt.
And it was great. I read it.
It was amazing. It was the kind of biography that would turn you into a fan of biographies, and then you start reading other ones and see that very few of them match up with Cook's biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. So the first one covered Eleanor Roosevelt from 1884, from her birth to 1933. Then several years later came the second volume, which was the defining years where Eleanor Roosevelt really became who we know her as, 1933 to 1938. And while nothing will ever equal in my mind that first volume, which I think anybody who's interested in strong women, interesting people, any biography fan who's missed that book should really go back and read it. The second volume was extremely interesting as well.
Well, now we're up to three, the war years and after. And how does that measure up?
Fabulous. Blanche Wisen Cook is a feminist. She's very interested in Eleanor Roosevelt as a kind of proto-feminist. And she brings Eleanor Roosevelt alive. And, you know, we talk about magisterial biographies, for years, people have been saying, when is the third volume coming out? Please, Dr. Cook, please stay alive and finish that book, because it was so long. And now she has, and we have the book. And what I'm hoping is that the publisher will reissue it as a set, because I think it'd be a fabulous gift, holiday gift or birthday gift.
Okay, publishers, you hear that. The book is Blanche Weisen Cook's Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After. Sitting next to that is a new novel by, I would say, probably one of the country's finest novelists, contemporary novelist, Michael Chabon.
Yes, and it's called Moonglow. And having read his books from the beginning, and having enjoyed many of his books a lot, I have to say that I think Moonglow was the book he was born to write. I mean, if this does not win some major literary awards, something is very wrong.
Well, he's already won major literary
awards.
He
has, but not for this book. I mean, this book is a young man writing the biography of his grandfather, with his grandfather helping him by filling in the spaces. You know, there's history, there's philosophy, there's humor, there's tragedy. Everything is here, and he just handles it absolutely wonderfully. I kind of envy, even at this point, people who haven't read it yet and still have those the book ahead of them, because I just was so absolutely taken with it. So the reason that I wanted to talk about these early is that these are going to be both, I think, big books, lots of holds at the library. The bookstore should have lots of copies. So, but I would still say get your reserves in very quickly.
Okay, the early tout from Nancy Pearl for books coming out November 1st, Michael Chabon's Moonglow, and then the third volume of Blanche Weisen Cook's trilogy biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After. Wow, Nancy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bringing you the early tout, that's Marcy Silman and Nancy Pearl. And you'll find all of Nancy's book picks at KUOW.org. Lobbyists are paid to try to influence legislation. One way they build relationships with lawmakers is by hosting political fundraisers. That's happening a lot this election season with lobbyists for business and labor and other interests, too. KUOW's Austin Jenkins staked out a fundraiser in Tacoma.
I'm outside the Wells Fargo building, where a group of mostly business lobbyists is hosting a fundraiser for House Republican floor leader J.T. Wilcox. Now, he's up for re-election, but he's also a key player in Republican efforts to take control of the Washington House this November.
Hi, J.T.
I caught Wilcox as he was arriving for the event in his trademark blue jeans and cowboy boots. He was a bit surprised.
An ambush, huh?
But he did take a few minutes to talk with me before going inside.
I would say, first of all, it's people that I know anyway. I don't keep track of who brings money, who doesn't.
The lobbyists on the invitation for this event represent banks, oil companies, restaurants, also doctors, dentists, and farmers. There were lobbyists for Amazon, Costco, FedEx, and Monsanto.
How concerned should the public be about the relationship between lawmakers and lobbyists?
I think that people should scrutinize contributions to politicians of both sides. I don't think that money itself is the problem. It's whether or not people are providing quid pro quo.
Something Wilcox points out would be illegal. But what about access? John Dunbar is with the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. He says lobbyists host fundraisers because it helps cement their role as a conduit between their clients and elected officials.
So these lobbyists get their phone calls returned. If they need a meeting, they get a meeting. And very often they may actually write pieces of legislation or put the kibosh on certain types of legislation.
Now, that characterization bothers one longtime Washington state lobbyist. His name is Charles Brown, and he was one of the hosts for the J.T. Wilcox event.
The relationship between a lobbyist and a legislator is fundamentally similar to that of a constituent and a legislator in terms of sharing information and concerns that they might have over issues.
Brown also notes that Washington has strict campaign contribution limits and strict disclosure rules. So far this year, Washington lobbyists have reported $5 million in campaign checks they personally wrote or delivered on behalf of their clients. It's not clear how much of that money changed hands at lobbyist-hosted fundraisers, But these events are popular.
I think there was shrimp cocktail. A couple lobbyists brought a couple bottles of wine.
That's Democrat Roger Goodman. He's the chair of the House Public Safety Committee, and he's recalling a July reception at the home of a lobbyist in a gated community in Olympia. But he says it's not what you might think.
It's not just corporate lobbyists, big money lobbyists.
He says there were lobbyists there for cities and for courts, interests that can't even make political contributions. As for undue influence, Goodman points not to Olympia, Washington, but to Washington, D.C.
Democrats and Republicans are bought and paid for there. And I saw that, and I actually had to participate in that as the chief of staff to a member. And I expected the same thing in Olympia, but it is entirely different.
He calls Olympia collegial, but not corrupt. Over and over again, state lawmakers told me their door is open to anyone, not just lobbyists and campaign contributors. As if to prove the point, J.T. Wilcox invited me to come out to his house in rural Pierce County. Wilcox showed me the view of Mount Rainier from his back deck, and then we sat down to talk about who has more sway, lobbyists or the public.
Your job is not to make just a few people happy. It's to balance the interests of many. And if you don't do that, if you don't look out for the taxpayer and the voter, they find out, and you're not going to be here.
As for how the fundraiser in Tacoma went, Wilcox said he raised a little bit of money and ate a leathery piece of chicken. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
And this is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. I am going to guess you have seen that famous shaky, blurry video of Bigfoot, or Sasquatch, as we call them around here. This is the clip of a big, hairy creature walking on two legs toward the trees and then glancing back at the camera for a split second. Well, you're about to hear the story of the man who helped capture that film clip. Bob Gimlin is a rancher from Central Washington. In a profile for Outside Magazine, writer Leah Satilli tells us what happened in 1967 when Bob Gimlin joined the man with the camera, Roger Patterson.
They were rodeo buddies. And Patterson, who was the Bigfoot aficionado, said, "I got to tell you about all this Bigfoot stuff I've been seeing and getting into." And over time, Gimlin, the non-believer, was kind of wooed into, yeah, maybe there is something out there. And so when Patterson heard about tracks in the Redwoods in Northern California, he asked Gimlin to drive him down because he had a horse trailer and that sort of thing. So they went looking for Bigfoot and saw Bigfoot. So they were in the woods for a number of weeks. I believe they were there for over 30 days. And they were kind of getting ready to pack it up and take it back home again because they'd been gone for so long, when they kind of rounded this bend one day and they smelled, then saw this big hairy beast walking through the woods and were caught it on film.
For those who haven't seen that film, I certainly have.
Yeah.
Many, many times. It was a great obsession of mine as a child. Will you relate the story of what supposedly happened at that moment?
On the film?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what they saw was supposedly, I think the creature was crouching or something near a riverbed. But what they captured on film was this female Bigfoot or Sasquatch.
How do we know it's a female?
She had large breasts.
Oh,
and so,
I didn't notice that as
yeah,
a child.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, I mean, when and now the film has really been kind of like worked over and remastered and that kinds of thing. So you can see it a lot clearer, but probably when you saw it as a kid, you were seeing that rough, really shaky
yep.
cut of it.
Yep.
So they see this female Bigfoot walking at a pretty brisk pace away from them and does the signature look over the shoulder at
yeah.
them and before it disappears into the woods.
Right.
So that look over the shoulder, I think, is the thing that everybody knows
oh, yes.
As Bigfoot.
Yes. The subject of many a meme.
Yes.
And again, if that was somebody in a gorilla suit, they played it cool. I mean, the Bigfoot is not hamming it up, right? It's
right.
just, it's that one brief look over, like a quizzical look over the shoulder, and then it's got
like,
she's
are
got
you following
someplace
me?
To go.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Yeah, and that is the question, is that over the years, people have come out and said, "I was the guy in the costume. I sold them the costume," this, that, and the next thing, but no one has been able to definitively prove that. There are no receipts. There's no proof of this legend or this prank in the making. You know, there really is a lot of question into whether it's real or not.
I hear some credulousness there.
Yeah. I mean,
Leah?
It was interesting because I think that everybody enters this idea as a complete skeptic, right? I mean, Bigfoot, how do we not, how do we believe in that? when I started to try and find, okay, then what is the evidence disproving it? I was not able to find that.
And the story is that Bob Gimlin was one of those skeptics before he wasn't. And this, you profiled Bob Gimlin. Tell us more about him.
Sure. Yeah. So actually, my stumbling into the story was, I mean, as a kid, I loved the, you know, watching this footage. It was so mysterious. And I live in the Portland area and heard about this group called the Bigfoot Lunch Club, and they were hosting an event with Bob Gimlin. And I couldn't believe, I didn't think he was still alive. So I went to the event, heard him speak, saw that he was this kind of cartoonish cowboy figure in which this entire room was, you know, ready to just like get on their knees for him. They just treated him like he was the Pope.
What do you mean he was cartoonish?
He's just very, he looks like a character. He wears a big, huge hat and a big, huge belt buckle and Wranglers, and he talks like this.
Okay.
And it's real slow. So I was immediately drawn to him. And when I started just kind of looking into the Patterson-Gimlin film, realized every single book that I was reading or every article was giving Patterson's side and saying, Gimlin has never spoke about this film. So when I saw him that night, I just said, would you be willing to talk about it? And he said, sure. So I wondered how much of it was that no one had ever asked. And so over a series of phone calls and meetings in person, I was able to get Bob's side of the story.
How did Bob Gimlin's life change when that video came out in 1967?
Yeah. So when they got back home, Roger immediately, you know, thought he struck gold and wanted to take the film on tour, and he did. Bob was a lot more skeptical of what they even saw, said that he thought it looked way more impressive in person than what he saw on film, and he really wasn't all that excited about the idea of taking it on tour because he didn't feel this great need to see it again. He knew what he saw, whereas Roger wanted to raise the money to be able to go back to Northern California to go on another expedition to find this Bigfoot.
Wait a minute. How can Gimlin not have been excited by having seen Bigfoot with his naked eyes and they had video
of it? I think he was excited. I think he was just like, I have no idea what I saw. I just know that I have to get back to work and I have a family to take care of and that kind of thing.
Wait a minute.
So
I mean, he doesn't think it's someone in a suit. I mean, he saw Bigfoot. He doesn't want the world to know.
I think that's a great question. And I think that that actually speaks to central traits of Bob's character, which is, let me put it this way. When I wrote this story, his response was, gosh, that sure is a big fuss that we made. And I think he felt very much like telling his story was just making too big of a fuss, which I think is somewhat characteristic of someone who lives in a very rural area and works a very humble lifestyle. Whereas Roger wanted to get famous.
Okay.
Roger wanted to be the guy that saw Bigfoot.
That wasn't
did.
His style. So Roger,
yeah.
You go and take this
do
all
your
over.
Thing.
You do go. You be P.T. Barnum or whatever.
Exactly.
Around the world.
And Gimlin sold his rights off to the film for less than $10 because he was just like, I don't want anything to do with it anymore. So that was not the end of it, though, for Gimlin. Him just saying to people, I saw Bigfoot, made him seem crazy in this very small town where he always knew everyone. And all of a sudden, his word was kind of questioned, I think. And your word in that kind of an area where things are done with handshakes and a good word was thrown into question.
Oh.
And it made him seem crazy, I think, to be out about the fact that he saw or believed in Bigfoot when people were like, that's crazy.
So maybe that's why he wanted to back away from
it. Yeah, so he definitely backed away. Him and his wife, they both backed away. Bob didn't want to talk about it anymore because they didn't want to be the crazy people that believed in Bigfoot.
Patterson died almost 45 years ago.
Yeah, he died in his late 30s.
Yeah, 5 years after this video came out. Gimlin had been silent, but as you say, but now he's meeting with fans, right?
Absolutely,
he's going
yeah.
to going to Bigfoot conventions, Sasquatch conventions.
Yep.
Why?
Well, I think that it has to do a lot with the community that the internet built around Bigfoot. So whereas in the 60s and 70s saying, I saw Bigfoot, you're probably going to be the only person in a small town that's going to admit to that. But as time went on and the internet created these forums of people, ways for people who believe in Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster or whatever to get together and form a community when Bob was sort of convinced by other people to emerge from his silence about Bigfoot, he saw that this huge community had formed in a way based on what he had seen.
You have a quote in your story, somebody saying, meeting Bob Gimlin is like meeting the president or the pope.
Mm-hmm.
Why do people, you know, Sasquatch believers, Bigfoot believers, hold him in such high esteem?
Yeah, I think that that was my central interest in the story, was finding that out. And I think that these folks see him as something of a seer, as a prophet in a way, that he's the guy that saw the thing that they all believe in and live to tell the tale. And the fact that he has never backed down from the fact that he saw Bigfoot and that the film has never been disproven, it really is the holy grail. If they were able to find a receipt for the costume, that's out the window. But because it's held up over all of these years, I mean, we're rounding near the 50th year and hasn't been disproven. And look at all the ways that we have to do that. I think that that's what makes him so precious to this community.
Leah, we haven't really touched on the possibility that Bob Gimlin is just a big liar.
Yeah, yeah. And that was, you know, I felt like that was my job, is to really weigh in on what the skeptics think. There is a very prominent skeptic named Greg Long who wrote a book called The Making of Bigfoot. And it's really examining everyone that has said, I was the guy that sold the suit. I was the guy in the suit. And he brought up some really good points that I thought were interesting, not so much about whether the Patterson-Gimlin film is real, but whether or not the Bigfoot community can ever admit that maybe it was fake, that now there's an entire industry around Bigfoot. You know, you see him everywhere. On my way here today, I saw a Bigfoot sticker on the back of a car and in the shape of the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot. So it's an industry. There are museums. People charge hundreds of dollars to take people on expeditions, you know, in the Dark Divide near Mount Adams. They need it to be real because it's a livelihood for them at this point. And I thought that was a really interesting take on it.
What do you think, Leah? I want to know.
Well,
Sasquatch.
You know, I think the little kid in me wants to believe that there is a world that we live in where we don't know everything. And I think that that's exciting. Do I think that there are, you know, Sasquatch and Bigfeet or whatever all around us? No, I don't. Do I think that they saw something that day in the woods? That, yeah, I do. I do think that there's a lot of evidence that said that they did. That may have been a man in a suit. So it's hard for me. It's really hard for me to say. I'm just not willing to say that I'm a complete Bigfoot believer, but I'm open to the idea of it.
Leah, you have said that it's nice to have mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
I like the idea that we don't have everything figured out.
You're a journalist. Why would you want us to not have things figured out?
I recently did another story where I spoke to people who were a part of the Explorers Club. So people who have the first people who landed on the moon, the first people to get to the bottom of the ocean, they're all members. And I was speaking with the president about these sorts of things, mystery in the world. And he said, our members discovered a new species in Central Park. And I believe it was some kind of like bug or worm or something like that. And I love that idea that there are mysteries hidden in plain sight. So I think that that was a big part of what fueled me to continue reporting this, was that idea of, is there a mystery behind this story? Is there a possibility that there's something out there? And maybe has no one been willing to say that they're going to entertain that idea? You know, that they're too much of an adult to say that maybe there's a Bigfoot out there. I'm not too much of an adult to try and play with that idea, I guess.